Hello again and welcome back to Practice What You Teach, the new Heart Learning Group podcast. My name is James Sutton, the learning technologist for the Heart Learning Group.
My name is Nick Wilson-Clinch. I am course team leader for supported studies and digital champion. And with us, we have a very special guest today. Who's sitting across from me this morning?
Hi, everyone. My name is Kerry Pritchett, and I am the head of quality for the Heart Learning Group.
Lovely. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. Very excited to talk all things quality and teaching. I think first up, it would be great to talk a little bit about how you got to where you are and your journey to become head of quality and how that happened for you.
Yeah, absolutely, of course. So for those who don't know me, I started off in the health and social care department with Nadia.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
wow.
Nadia was my head of curriculum and I've been a thorn in her side ever since.
Oh my gosh.
I started as a learning coach way back, it must be at least 14 years ago now.
So you've been here for about 14 years?
I think it's about 14 years. Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
I hadn't been in teaching very long. I'd had about a year's or so experience at an independent training provider as a learning support assistant, and then joined college as a learning coach, delivering what we now know as PAD. Back then it was the Bridge program, the tutorial program. And I then did my teacher training and became a lecturer in health and social care, teaching level 3 with Mia at the time, Mia Newbit, another colleague who we've worked together for a few years. I became quite interested in teaching, not only as a specialist teacher in health and social care, but teaching more generally. You know, what made great teaching?
Sure.
From there, it was an opportunity to become a LIF, which is the old name that we have for our current TLCs.
What does LIF stand for? There's so many acronyms in our job. It's ridiculous.
So we were, the first incarnation, we were learning improvement and innovation facilitators.
Quite a fancy name.
That then got shortened to learning improvement facilitators. So I'm not quite sure what that tells you about the innovation qualities of the first group of LIFs. An opportunity arose. I think I was a LIF for a year, possibly two. And then an opportunity arose to join the quality team as a deputy head of quality, which I've very, very lucky to be offered that promotion in that particular role. And then as things change and, you know, people move, the head of quality role became available.
How many years ago was that?
I think I've been head of quality for 7 or 8 years.
Oh, wow, quite a while.
Off the top of my head. Certainly pre-COVID.
Right.
As I'm sure for many, the pandemic slightly interrupts my timeline
it's
and
like
my memory.
That moment disappeared almost.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I know I was head of quality during the pandemic, so it's got to have been.
That has become everyone's marker for everything. Was like, did I do it in COVID or not?
Yeah.
I was quite lucky to have, I took a break from education right during COVID. So I've heard about all of the creative ways that people still delivered teaching to students, and I can't imagine how hard that must have been through COVID. Yeah. I feel quite lucky that I joined back in once COVID had done. I didn't do that on purpose. It was seemingly a happy accident, but it sounds like you guys had quite a time of making sure you could provide good teaching and learning still.
From my point of view, that was very much where the technology came into focus, because it was people grappling with the technology that they needed to master to deliver and engage with their learners who were suddenly found themselves in isolation. It was particularly challenging.
Is that where you found your interest then?
No, I mean, the interest had always been there. But I think that it was then necessary. My skills became necessary in a way that they hadn't been before.
Sure.
I almost felt in my comfort zone at that point. But I think
during COVID?
With the technology,
right.
And what I needed
just
to do.
Loved COVID.
Wasn't it amazing? But Kerry, would you agree? I think teachers really struggled during that time, didn't they?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my personal memories of working through the pandemic were I set up a small home office in our house, and I sort of lived by that desk for but it felt like a very long time, grappling with awarding body guidance, trying to work out, you know, sort of what the processes were, what the quality assurance processes needed to be, particularly around the centre assessed grades and the teacher assessed grades that came through those years. But I think one thing that really struck me about the pandemic and teaching was the resilience and the creativity of our teachers.
Right.
Seeing, you know, within, I think we had a week's notice that, that the college was going to shut.
You had a week? Oh, my goodness.
We had a week's notice. And I could be wrong in my memory here, but we it was about a week. And then we knew that we were going to close as an organisation. And then I think about a week later, the actual lockdown was announced.
So you had a week to prepare your students.
Absolutely.
I seem to remember at the time that there was a lot of government uncertainty.
Yeah.
And that was leaving us feeling very unsure about what would happen next. And I think, yeah, you're right, Kerry. It was very, felt very last minute.
Yeah. What impressed me, as I said, is the resilience and the creativity of teachers to be able to pivot in such a way when, you know, to be frank, we as a quality team also didn't fully understand the technology or the impact or you know, the effects of what would happen to be able to deliver an engaging education experience online. But the messages that I got through from managers and from directors and from SMT saying, look at what this teacher is doing, look at this example of what they're doing, it forced us to take risks and to consider different ways of teaching in an environment where sort of that capacity to be forced to do something isn't perhaps existent within our current practice. So seeing that creativity come through was inspiring.
That's amazing. I teachers have to be super adaptable as well, don't they? In all of the things that we do, it's such an important thing. And I think that's kind of leads into what we're talking about today about taking risks in the classroom and how we can feel more comfortable to do so. I guess it sounds like teachers are almost forced to be adaptable and creative in that setting, and maybe we're back in our safe space now, and it's now about how we push those boundaries. Now we're back in our comfort zone, which is a very, very different space to be in, isn't it?
Yeah, so it loops back, I think, to what Kit was saying at the start of the year. We had a very good, a very successful Ofsted result, but there is scope to improve on that. There was the whole analogy of getting off the carousel onto the roller coaster, which involves some risk taking, which I think, as you pointed out, Kerry, we were almost forced to take those risks during COVID. I think when we're back teaching face-to-face, that can be harder. I know in the conversations that I've had with teachers that, especially when they're being observed, they're scared of taking risks because they don't want to let the side down. I think when we're being inspected externally by external bodies such as Ofsted as well, it can be all the harder because you don't want to let the side down. You don't want to be seen to fail.
Yeah, well, you're part of a team, aren't you? And you want to make sure you're doing your part. But again, that's why people stay in their comfort zones, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And you, I think, as Adam said in the introduction, you play your greatest hits. You do the things that you know work. But innovation requires risk-taking and some failures that we can celebrate. It's funny that when we're recording, if somebody makes a mistake, we clap. And that, in a sense, that's what we want to do for our teaching.
Yes,
when we
yeah.
see something going wrong, if it's part of an innovation, people clap. And this has been a theme in my thinking as early as March this year, coming back from DigiFest. And recently, I was listening to Gavin Newsom being interviewed by Stephen Bartlett as part of his podcast. And Gavin Newsom, who's the governor for California, who has dyslexia himself and was talking about his own struggles and how many failures he's experienced, was talking about how within his own businesses had found ways to reward failure. He'd give people bonuses for their best failures. So, and Kerry, I'm wondering, how do we introduce that into our processes, do you think, within quality? Obviously, as part of our own team, we're thinking about how we do deep dives, how we can support teachers.
And how does that look for teachers on the ground level? Like, how can we still feel we're doing our best whilst being able to push ourselves to getting things wrong and not feeling pressure not to do so?
I think it's a really interesting and difficult question to answer. I think there's a number of threads running through our current quality processes and our current teaching processes that will help to support more of a creative risk-taking attitude and culture towards teaching and learning. I think it's really important that we define what we mean by failure. Failure in and of itself is not necessarily a negative thing. What is important around failure is that we have tried something new, tried something exciting.
Yeah. Kind of like this podcast, it could be a complete flop.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'll be very honest, I'm very nervous sitting here with a microphone, but if I can't talk about encouraging staff to try new things if I myself can't, you know, come to this and be brave and be bold and think, you know, what are we talking
about? Practice what you teach.
Absolutely. So it's about the trying, and it's about how we respond to the failure. If we respond to failure in a constructive way, reflect upon it. As teachers, and I still consider myself a teacher.
Of course.
As teachers, we are reflective practitioners. It's part of our bread and butter. So try something. If it goes wrong, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, well, what do we learn from that? How do we take, because even within failure, there are things that go right. So why did the things that went well work? Why did the things that didn't go well not work?
Yeah.
And then how are we going to try again with those small changes or big changes to then, you know, continue that practice through? So when we talk about failure and celebrating failures, we're celebrating the risk-taking, we're celebrating the innovation, we're celebrating this could be done differently, not necessarily better, but differently. Mm. So reflecting on Adam's use of the term, the greatest hits, we know the greatest hits work. We know they are... You know, I've still got lessons in my head that I possibly slightly rustily could roll out if someone was coming to observe me.
Sure.
But just because they work, that doesn't mean they're the best version of themselves. How do we get that incremental change, creativity and challenge?
I think part of the issue, especially for me, is almost around the word observation. When I know I've got an observation, it kind of makes your body go a bit stiff, and it's kind of right. It's time to do my absolute best. So I wouldn't necessarily naturally want to try my new idea. Is there a way around that we can maybe input ideas of risk taking into the observation themselves?
Yes, absolutely. I appreciate the term observation in and of itself can be a blocker. It's that concept that someone, regardless of how perhaps the process is presented, someone is coming to see what you're doing, and that can cause worry and anxiety. And I totally understand and can see that. I was equally very nervous around observations when I was a teacher, or if I know other managers are coming to join the staff development session that I'm leading.
I guess that's your form of observation isn't it?
Yeah, it absolutely is. It gives you that rumble deep in your stomach around, okay, I've got to be on my A game. I've got to really deliver something.
And there's nothing bad about that, is there? Being forced to be put on your A game is not a bad thing. No. And it's good to feel that energy in your stomach, because it kind of gets you out of maybe the autopilot you might have been in. It kind of wakes you up, doesn't it? So that there is good to that feeling as well, isn't there? It's not inherently a bad thing to have that feeling in your gut.
It's turning that energy into an impetus to innovate, isn't it? Rather than letting it freeze you or halt you or stop you, which can happen.
Of course.
And I just wanted to reflect back as well. I think there's a history to that fear. Obviously, there's an association going back we don't like being observed doing during our driving test, for example. The last time that we had our Ofsted inspection, Ofsted itself was having particularly bad press at the time because of some negative things that had happened. They are saying that they've listened and they're wanting to move beyond that. So they've had a similar experience, I would say, and it's how, again, how we can foster that same attitude.
Absolutely. And what, Kerry, what do you think teachers can do in the classroom to start taking these risks, especially leaning into technology? Like, is there any things that you as part of, or as head of the quality team would like to see or would could suggest to people who want to start taking more creative risks?
Yeah, and this is where I'm going to struggle with the detail, and I've got two very experienced digital individuals sitting across the table from me. I think for me, it's risk doesn't have to be huge.
Yes.
So it's not tear up your scheme of learning and replace it with something, you know.
With a dance.
With a dance. I mean,
interpretive dance. This is going to look like this.
It's about working out where those most impactful changes are. So when we look at writing quality improvement plans for curriculum areas and for the organisation as a whole, what we encourage curriculum managers to do is to think about a maximum of three or four things they want to improve within that academic year. So when you're thinking about, you know, the breadth and depth of teaching and learning, of student experience, of achievement rates, high grades, attendance, personal development, behaviours and attitudes, actually refining a quality improvement plan to only three things is quite tricky.
Sure.
You know, it's, but you're thinking about if I only make improvement on those three things, I'm going to get the most impact at the end of the academic year. And I would encourage teachers to think the same way about their teaching practice. You can't change anything and everything all in one go. It has to be a measured, thought through process. Thinking about the detail around which are the very key things I wish to change that will have the most impact at the end of the year. And especially, you know, we are a good organisation. We've got...
With outstanding features.
With outstanding features. I believe we are outstandingly good, I think was the phrase that we went for, which actually makes improvement perhaps even harder.
Yes, that's a really good point, isn't it? Yeah, because we've only got a small bit to go. So it's, yeah, how do we fill that small gap?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's incremental changes now. We've seen really fantastic achievement rates in study programmes last year. You know, we're seeing improvements within adults, within support, you know, within high needs, apprenticeships. So everything is moving in the right direction. So finding those incremental changes becomes harder. One thing I would really encourage teachers to become involved in, if they aren't already, are the action research projects within the departments. The action research projects give you a framework to think about what are the things, two things that I need to improve within my practice or can support colleagues to improve within a curriculum team. Mm. And work through in that structured plan, do, review model, which will take you through the academic year in terms of looking at an item, thinking about how you can change it, reflecting on it on an individual and a collective level, and coming together again to think about, okay, we've tried that, this bit worked, this bit didn't, how can we now get that in our next stage of action research?
Sure. Have you seen, with the action research project so far, have you witnessed and seen impact for teachers with it? Is there situations in which we can attest to that have worked as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I think for me, the biggest impact last year was the adoption of action research as a process in and of itself.
Yeah, as an ongoing thing.
Absolutely.
Right?
It's a mindset around how do I continue to make my practice even better? Mm. And that is where I think we've seen that impact of teachers getting together. I've seen some wonderful activities in curriculum teams where within meetings or within particular time slots set aside for action research and for professional development, teachers have got together to talk about what they're doing, how they're making it better and moving it forward. In the February CPD day last year and then in the July CPD Day last year, we held activities where teachers got together and we organised groups with similar themes that they were looking at. So we had a digital group, maths and English group, et cetera, et cetera. And teachers from across the organisation got together to talk about what they were working on, how it was impacting their learners and how it was developing their teaching. And from that, we saw peer observations being arranged, you know, swapping of resources across areas.
How does someone, so you've got the action research project, which you're looking at as a team. How does then a teacher then take that into their specific classroom? I think sometimes it can be hard to see the big picture and then see it, right, what am I doing on a granular level? Like, what am I going to do today in the classroom that's different? I think that's sometimes something that people struggle with. What could that look like?
Thinking about it on a daily basis is possibly more challenging.
Sure.
Because what we're not expecting is every lesson to be creative and innovative. It is. Fair. I mean, I'm certainly expecting from a quality point of view, every day to be a good day, learners making progress, learners, being enthusiastic and enjoying their work. But you can't expect to find within your practice on every day or every lesson that there is something that either needs to be changed or can be changed, because that would be overwhelming.
Yeah, and we're human, we can't be perfect every day.
Absolutely. You can't be perfect every day and you can't be expected to be innovative and creative and change stuff every day. So I would think about, let's say, for example, your action research project is on digital. So the first thing we know and we say is you can't shoehorn digital into every lesson.
Mm-hmm.
You can't shoehorn it into every unit or structural topic or theme that you're working through. But you can identify the best fit or the best place where that change or innovation can happen. So if you are working on an action research project at a department level, it's thinking reflectively about your own practice and identifying where it will be most impactful. So it might be that your team is doing something around body swaps, for instance, the VR technology. So that is going to have the most impact in units around careers development or work-ready behaviours. It's not potentially going to have the same impact in a very skills-based unit where you're learning to do something very relevant to the sector that you're going into. So those units or that topic, you might not do anything differently with this year, but you might do something differently with your work-ready behaviours topic or with your tutorial program. So it's about being selective and thinking about where it's going to have the most impact.
Sorry to play devil's advocate a little bit. So say that you've got your one yearly observation and it is in a unit and during a lesson where some of those things you would like to showcase are not going to be in.
What I would encourage a teacher in that situation to do is to have a conversation with their observer. So in all observations, there should be a pre-observation discussion. You should have a coaching discussion with your observer before you go into the actual observation itself. And that should be around what you're intending to get out of the lesson, what the plans are, any particularly tricky bits that you're anticipating. And that conversation should then enable both yourself as a teacher and the observer to get the most out of the observation itself. Observations here are based on a coaching model. Observations are there to support teachers to develop, to practice something new, to be innovative and creative. So if you've agreed a date that then won't work because your curriculum has changed or you're adapting your planning to meet the needs of the learners, and actually a different session would give you as the teacher more opportunity to demonstrate a new practice, then I would encourage you to chat with your observer around that and say, actually, could you come in on Friday at 9 instead of Monday at 3 so that I can show you something I've been working on?
Sure.
And that, for me, is what observation should be about.
Yeah. I'd really like to amplify what Kerry's been saying, because I think we're living at a time where broadly learner over-reliance on technology outside of the classroom has never been higher. whether that's personal devices or over-reliance on AI to complete work and what have you, it's vital that we don't shoehorn technology in where it isn't needed, because we are the antidote to that over-reliance within the classroom. So we should encourage our learners to be having conversations with each other and with their tutors as much as possible as part of the teaching and learning process, for that learning process to become more Socratic, where learners are learning from their tutor and from each other through discussion where possible, because it's that development of soft skills. So for example, there, looping it back to Kerry, you mentioned VR. That's great that people are learning those soft skills in VR, but they need to be practicing them face to face. And so the VR is very much, in my mind, a scaffolding tool to help them towards that. It's not the end. It's not going to give them those skills that they need fundamentally. So I think it's never been more important that we listen to what you're saying and follow that through in the way that we design our lessons. I know that access to technology can be a challenge to teachers within classrooms at the moment, and I'm sure that will change over time. But learners all have access to their own technology, and we can teach them to use that technology more appropriately rather than telling them not to use it.
Yeah, rather than demonizing the phone.
Guide them in that usage.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, all teachers have a mild hatred of mobile phones because of the trouble it can cause us. But I think maybe if we can figure out how to use it more creatively as a resource, it's a win-win. Would you say, Kerry?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's about ensuring that the digital skills we look at developing within the classroom and the digital tools we look to use creatively are also linked to industry. So actually,
yes, of course.
Another way to think about how, Nick, you asked earlier around, you know, how can teachers take something broader and put it into their own practice, is think about what would be relevant for your industry. We're all dual practitioners in FE. We often have a trade background or a vocational background before we came into teaching. So when you're thinking about, okay, so how shall I use digital technologies to enhance my teaching and learning, it's thinking about which ones would have the most impact on those learners once they've left and gone on to further education.
Such a good point. I think sometimes we forget how quickly digital technology moves as well. So making sure you're up to date with that. Kerry, do you miss teaching?
Yes.
Wow, immediate yes. response. Really?
Yes. I don't always miss the marking. I miss being in the classroom. I miss being with students. I miss seeing students that start with you in September as one thing and then leave you in June as another thing.
Yes, that's amazing. It's such a beautiful thing to witness, yeah. Isn't it?
That's what we're here for, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, that is the whole point.
Literally the whole point.
Yeah, it must be hard because you know, you are slightly more separated from the students. You know, the teachers are more your students now, I guess.
In a way.
So we are the ones that you see grow now, which is still, well, must be lovely to see teachers grow and change as well. But there is something really special about being on the ground with the students and seeing them turn into adults, which is, like James says, why we're here. What's your favourite thing about being in quality?
I think my favourite thing about being in quality, I'll answer it in a slightly different way.
Sure.
When I deliver observation training, so anybody that observes within the Heart Learning Group has to attend observation training with me to go through what it means for us, what the processes are, to really reinforce the messages I've been saying earlier around observations are a creative process and are an opportunity for teachers to experiment and be creative and brave and bold. When I deliver that observation training, one of the messages I really try to sort of impose upon the observers or the new observers within that room is it's a real honour and privilege to be invited into other people's teaching spaces.
Yes.
And to be able to see, you know, that practitioner deliver something, you know, to demonstrate their craft for you as an observer. And I think that essence, although I can't quite put it into words, is my favourite thing about working in the quality team.
Yeah, that's lovely. Just before we sign off, Kerry, tell us something that we don't know about you.
Oh, now that's a question. Let's think. I did once end up having 21 guinea pigs that lived in a shed at the end of the garden.
Yeah, you hear it. Heard it here first.
Can you... A guinea pig hoarder.
Is there a reason for the 21 guinea pigs, or did they just happen upon you?
We found one guinea pig abandoned at the side of a road.
Of course, okay.
You know,
as you do, see them hitching a ride.
we took them home, and guinea pigs should always live in pairs. So, an animal care tip for listeners out there. So, we bought a second guinea pig from a well-known pet store, who turned out to be expecting, which we didn't know. And let's just say one thing led to another. We had two girls, there was one boy in the litter, and it led to 21 guinea pigs.
That's a lot of guinea pigs.
It was. But they sound adorable when you
do 21 sound adorable though? I mean, or more like a demon?
Adorably loud, I think, is what I would say.
That is not what I was expecting you to say. Yes, lovely. Well, thank you so much for joining us. I know you're such a busy person and this was quite a strange request. And I know it might have been out of your comfort zone. And I appreciate that you've taken the time to get out your comfort zone and talk to us today. Like we said earlier, if anyone else would like to join us and be brave and step out their comfort zone, do please let us know. My email is nicholas.wilsonclinch@nhc.ac.uk.
And my email is jsutton@nhc.ac.uk. But as I've said before, please do message me on Teams if that comes more naturally for you, and we can plan some ideas.
And Kerry, how might people get in touch with you?
Exactly the same way. My email address is kpritchett@nhc.ac.uk. Grab me on Teams, give me a phone call, grab me in the corridor. You know, whenever you want to chat, let me know.
Amazing. Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you, Kerry.
My pleasure too.